In his own experience, cures rarely took as long as 3 months, and an interesting feature he observed is that the vast majority of patients seeking his help were non-spiritists. "If my hospital only treated spiritists," he once told an interviewer from Argentina, "we would have to close down, because so few of them are affected." Two of his cases of successful cure of obsessions were in fact of Catholic priests. 2. There are many large spiritist hospitals in Brazil, of which the best known are those in Porto Alegre, Itapira and São Paulo. The first of these, originally built in 1925 and moved to its present site in 1941, is particularly impressive, with 600 beds and a staff of more than 200. For 40 years it was directed by a former mayor of the city, Conrado Ferrari, who died in 1971. The kindly bearded face of Dr. Bezerra beams down from the wall of the main reception room, which is named after him. Spiritist hospitals make full use of conventional medicine. They make it clear that, as St. Paul put it, there is a natural body, and there is a spiritual body, and each must be treated accordingly, the former with medicine and the latter by spiritist methods. 3. As the Hilary Divaldo told me, medicine and mediums must get together, and they have come together to form regular associations in many of Brazil's leading cities. One of the most active of these is the Rio de Janeiro Society of Medicine and Spiritism, founded in 1941 by Dr. Levindo Mello, who died in 1964. Dr. Mello had an experience similar to that of Dr. Bezerra, when a spiritist medium cured a patient of his in 20 minutes after he had failed to do so in 4 months. In 1973, the Rio Society published evidence to suggest that they had identified a new form of disease, which they call spirit induction, and included 26 case histories ending in complete cure. A woman who had suffered blinding headaches for 29 years had been cured for 7 years after the spirit that had been causing her problem had been identified and persuaded to leave her alone. A 5-year-old boy had shown all the symptoms of tursine fever, a kind of malaria, since the age of a few months, though no trace of the agent that provokes this disease, Plasmodium vivax, could be found despite repeated tests. The boy undoubtedly had fever, but there was no organic cause. Therefore, society doctors concluded, the cause had to be spiritual in the literal sense of the word. Making what they call a paranormal diagnosis, they found that the disease was being induced by the spirit of a gold prospector who had died of malaria in the northern Goiás jungles. They treated the patient, and the spirit, accordingly, and the boy was cured at once. For 4 years subsequently, they reported, the boy had been free of fever. Other cases, of which the society has published full details, include the cure of a man who had been bothered for 2 months by an incessant cough. He was found to be suffering induction from a former tuberculosis patient. Another man, himself a doctor, had suddenly been struck dumb, making it impossible for him to continue his work as a lecturer. He had become so depressed that he thought of committing suicide, but was cured on the spot by the deinduction method and went back to work the following day. According to the Rio Doctor Spiritists, induction by a spirit can take the form of fever, tremors, itching, burning sensations, somnolence, stammering or cuckoos, a form of nervous facial tic. But anybody showing symptoms of any disease, they say, may be suffering from spirit induction if it is found that there is no organic cause. 4. São Paulo, it is often said, has everything if you take the trouble to look for it. It is a large and efficient spiritist federation, and a very active medical spiritist association, a MESP, and among the more unusual services this enormous city had to offer in the 1970s were those of a Catholic priest of European descent, whose work consisted largely of exorcising evil spirits and generally fighting black magic by the use of what appear to be conventional spiritist methods. Father Carlos, as he was known, held regular consultations in his church, welcoming members of all faiths who lined up by the hundreds to pour out their problems. He was usually booked in advance for private consultations for about 6 weeks. Instead of listening behind bars and handing out impositions of Hail Marys, he would roll up his sleeves and go after evil spirits in fighting mood. He would give his visitors magnetic passes according to the Spiritist book, and in extreme cases go to their homes to drive out the more obstreperous psi entities. He was not the first Catholic priest to try and fight the less desirable manifestations of the spirit world. Indeed, one of his best-known predecessors, Father Boventura Kloppenberg, carried out an energetic campaign for several years to wipe out spiritism altogether. An intelligent and basically kind-hearted man, Kloppenberg took the trouble to study his subject properly, and wrote four massive volumes on spiritism. Unfortunately for him, just after his books were published, there was a dramatic about-face in the Vatican party line after Pope Paul VI decided in his Africi Terrarum, 1967, that there might be some good after all in the primitive and non-Christian rites. Amazing as it may seem, the Church of Rome persists in regarding all forms of spiritism as pagan, despite the fact that Kardecists acknowledge no source of inspiration other than Jesus Christ, and Kardec himself stated explicitly that spiritism was Christianity restored. Later, Kloppenberg admitted to author David S.T. Clare that he had seen many things during his 10-year investigation of spiritism that he was unable to explain. He added that he had new duties, and that they took up a great deal of his time. 5. Father Carlos, the exorcist, is typical of a small minority of more realistic Brazilian Catholic priests, who are well aware of the existence of evil-minded spirits and try to do something about them without finding it necessary to bring down the whole structure of spiritism in the process. The worst plague we have here in São Paulo is all this black magic, Father Carlos said, revealing that a great many of those who sought his help were suffering from one of the most familiar of all paranormal phenomena, poltergeists. The São Paulo area seems to have attracted more than its fair share of these mysterious entities. The IBPP has records of no less than 32 of them, many of which were investigated by Andrade with his customary thoroughness. Much debate rages in the psi research community over the question of whether poltergeists are a purely psychological phenomenon caused. Nobody has yet attempted to explain how, by repressed teenagers, often around the age of puberty, or manifestations of some kind of discarnate entity or spirit. The second theory is not popular with non-spiritists, while as far as Brazilian spiritists are concerned it is the only one that makes any sense, and as we shall see there is a good deal of evidence to support it, including some I was able to collect myself. So fasten your seat belts. We are about to land in the poltergeist zone. 5. The poltergeist zone. Luisa, there's a hand on your bed. Lights were switched on hastily and cries of "Who said that?" hurled in all directions. But apparently nobody had said it, although everybody in the room swore they had heard the words. Ah well, they thought, better leave a light on, just in case. It was 11 p.m. on July 7th, 1972 in an old boarding house on Rue Agassiz, just a block or two from the main banking district of São Paulo, Latin America's largest city. 17 young women lived there, and 5 of them shared the upstairs room where the mysterious voice had addressed one of them. Half an hour later, a pan of milk took off from its position on top of a cupboard and zigzagged its way slowly to the floor, splashing drops of milk around but landing upright with most of its contents unspilt. This was enough to give the women a thorough fright, though it was nothing compared to what was in store for them. The next day, after a bad night's sleep, 4 of them went to ask a local priest for help. They also bought a bottle of holy water and placed it on a chair. The priest duly came, said prayers all over the place and blessed the frightened women. As he walked down the staircase, a bottle was flung after him, smashing against the front door. He left and never came back. Shortly afterwards, the bottle of holy water rose slowly into the air, hovered over the woman resting on the nearest bed, and spilled its entire contents over her. This seemed to be the signal for an attack on all fronts by the poltergeist, and from then on all hell broke loose. A pan of macaroni shot out of the upstairs kitchen down into the hallway. Glassware from inside a locked drawer was smashed on the marble stairs. An expensive pair of spectacles was snatched from its wearer's nose and flung on the floor. A jar of honey left a locked glass-fronted kitchen shelf, without breaking the glass, and hurled itself against the tiled wall, scattering honey and glass fragments all over the place. Even heavy objects like a clothes iron and a waste bucket were projected down the staircase. It all went on for about 3 weeks, on and off, mostly on. Some of the women went to sleep with a neighbor, a bedridden lady who had heard regular screams of terror coming from the boarding house. The others huddled together in the downstairs bedrooms at night, few of them managing more than a few hours' sleep. The ghost even began to play elaborate practical jokes. One tenant put 3 10-kruzero banknotes in her handbag and locked the bag in her cupboard, only to find the notes missing when she took the bag out again. She found them stuffed inside a bottle rolling around the floor downstairs. 3 carloads of police searched the house from top to bottom on the track of some skillful prankster, but found nothing, and left after making some indecent suggestions to the young women and complaining that this sort of thing was out of their hands. 2 more priests were called to the house by the desperate owner, who feared he was going to lose all his tenants, but to no avail. The house soon became the talk of the neighborhood, and several illustrated articles on the disturbances appeared in local magazines and newspapers. Finally, as usual in Brazil on such occasions, the women, most of whom were Catholics, turned to the last resort, spiritism. The first father in sainthood they called in accepted an advance fee of 50 cruzeiros, then worth about $10, for his services, which consisted of impaling the front door of the house with a dagger. This soon disappeared and so did he. They had better luck with their next father, a young man from a nearby Candomblé center, who visited the house frequently for 6 days, announced that the damage was the work of a mischievous spirit, summoned one of his own spirit guides to help him out, planted candles and glasses of rum at strategic points around the house, and promised the women there would be no more trouble. He was absolutely right, and the phenomena ceased as abruptly as they had begun. To make doubly sure, the young exorcist took one of the tenants, suspected as being what researchers call the psychokinetic agent or epicenter, along to his premises and gave her a thorough spiritual spring cleaning, sacrificing a goat to the spirit that had been bothering her for good measure. And so peace returned to Ruagasses. After IBPP researchers had taped more than 6 hours of testimony from 23 witnesses, and concluded that it was another case of a perturbed teenager attracting forces that were converted into what is known in the trade as RSPK or recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis, random physical violence. The 24-year-old Candomblé exorcist was happy to tell researchers how he had driven out the spirit. An exhumorse ago, he explained, was a type of pagan spirit dwelling in the shadows, probably that of a former criminal who had nothing better to do than bother people. Pagan spirits have to vegetate, he explained further, wandering around in the darkness until they can reincarnate or just stay where they are. But I've been in the cult since I was 8 years old, and I know how to deal with these situations. He had, he said, enticed the pagan spirit out of the house by promising to sacrifice a goat for him and giving him a drink of beer. Then he had taken the spirit to the cult center, where he promised to treat him with love and kindness, and eventually to domesticate him. He also deserves our respect, he added. This may sound to some like superstitious nonsense, yet it undoubtedly worked. Probing into the background of the case, IBPP researchers found that as so often where there is a poltergeist, there is, or was, somebody with a grudge. The owner of the boarding house had been badly hurt in a car accident some time before, and had spent 6 months in hospital. Assuming him to be on the point of death, another man had managed to get possession of the house, and the wife of this other man had died shortly afterwards. It was generally thought that she might have had a grudge against the original owner, who recovered, and might have caused the disturbances in revenge. According to the dictionary, A poltergeist is a ghost that manifests itself by noises and rappings. The word coming from the German poltern, to make a racket, and geist, ghost. To most of us, poltergeists are simply things that go bump in the night. In Brazil, they also go bump in the daytime, and are not content with merely bumping. They throw rocks around, overturn furniture, wreck kitchens, set clothing on fire, soak rooms with water, rearrange people's personal belongings and often steal them, transport anything from babies to two-ton trucks, and generally drive a lot of peace-loving citizens out of their minds. There is also evidence that they do far worse things, seriously wounding and even killing people. They are infernal nuisances and there ought to be a law against them. July 1972 was a vintage month for poltergeist activity in Brazil, and at one point IBPP researchers found themselves working on three cases at once, two more in addition to the one described above. The first of these manifested itself in the town of Sorocaba, 63 miles west of São Paulo. It was an interesting case in that the poltergeist was not content with chasing a whole family out of its house, but followed it to another house and virtually wrecked the entire establishment. It began on July 18 in the modest home of Fernando, a 48-year-old house painter, his wife Alda, and their six children. First signs of action were loud knockings, and then household objects started flying about and breaking, almost every single piece of furniture in the house being overturned, some of them more than once. A heavy wooden shutter was wrenched off its hinges, and a bizarre touch was provided by a large motor tire in the backyard which simply rose 3 feet into the air and stayed there for a few moments, long enough to scare Fernando out of his wits. Tipped off by a local resident, four IBPP researchers rushed to the scene, arriving 4 days after the initial manifestation. Hernani Gomes Andrade and two of his sons, Sergio and Ricardo, began to make a survey of the six-room premises and take photographs of pieces of smashed furniture, while Suzuko Hashizume stood at the window of the front room, tape recorder around her neck, talking to Alda and examining the broken shutter. Every member of the household was under observation by one or more of the IBPP team. Nobody was in the kitchen except the family poodle, which was asleep on the floor. Suddenly there was a thunderous crash, followed by a sharp yelp as the little dog ran limping and whining out of the kitchen. Everybody rushed in to find a heavy wooden shelf lying on the floor well away from the wall. 12-year-old Yara was comforting the terrified dog, which seemed to have hurt one of its paws when the shelf fell. The researchers photographed the shelf and lifted it back to its normal position, deciding it was far too heavy for the dog to have knocked it over accidentally even if it had been awake, and waited to see if it would fall again. The poltergeist failed to oblige, so they went on with their work. It was the first time they had recorded an unmistakable paranormal phenomenon on tape, though it was not to be the last. There were some interesting features of the Sorocaba case. The poltergeist had begun its activity outside the house with raps, stone throwing and tile levitation, and had then moved indoors, working its way methodically through every room in order. It had overturned every single piece of furniture in the house, wrecking some of them beyond repair. Not only that, but when the family had moved out to stay with relatives, it had followed them and done the same again. It looked as if a tractor had driven through the place, a neighbor commented. When they moved back to their own home, the trouble began again, though their relatives were left in peace amid their wreckage. At the Rue Agassiz boarding house nobody had been hurt except a woman who had fallen downstairs in fright, but at Sorocaba the situation had become dangerous. Alda was hit on the head by a flying brick, and one of the girls had scalding water spilt on her face and dress as the kettle she was boiling to make coffee was wrenched from her hands. The most impressive feat of all was the overturning of a concrete water tank, which according to Fernando normally took 3 men to lift. This had simply been raised from its brick support and dumped on its face in the backyard. It is an appalling thought what poltergeists could do if they felt like it, or were able to. What they do already is bad enough. The Sorocaba case was never satisfactorily solved, as the family decided they had had enough and left town, and the IBPP lost touch with them. The researchers reckoned they had identified 12-year-old Yara as the agent, for she had been present on all occasions where there had been violence, and on most of them she had been well in view of other members of the family. An interesting detail was that although the poltergeist seemed to have no qualms about performing in broad daylight, it would never do anything at night when lights were switched on. It was just as if it knew somebody was trying to catch it in the act. The third poltergeist case to come to light in July 1972 was the most bizarre of all. It was also the longest lasting, for it had been going on for more than 3 years before word of it reached Sao Paulo. Kenzo Okamoto was a Japanese immigrant farmer who lived some 12 miles from the remote town of Pontapora in the state of Mato Grosso, just across the frontier in Paraguay. This is a thinly populated area largely devoted to agriculture and, it is alleged, smuggling. The trouble began when a Paraguayan peasant bought a bunch of bananas and sat down by the roadside to eat some. He ate one, and then noticed that two of his original dozen had disappeared. He ate another, and four more vanished. He decided to hide what was left of his bunch, and immediately received a hard blow on the back. This caused him to faint from shock, and when he came round he hurried off to tell his story to friends, none of whom believed him. At about the same time, a poltergeist invaded the house of a neighbor of Okamoto's. A bed was lifted into the air at night, and occupants of the house were pushed around by an invisible force, which then proceeded to throw a number of objects out of the house. Everybody left the building in terror, except for one stout old lady of 76, who worked on Okamoto's tomato patch. One day, she was bombarded by green tomatoes as she was working in the patch. Thinking Okamoto was playing tricks with her, she threatened to call the police, but the bewildered farmer assured her he had nothing to do with it. Some days later, two of his own children received a pelting of tomatoes, ripe ones this time, which stained their clothes and caused incipient panic all round. Next, the poltergeist moved in with the Okamoto family. Stones began to fall on the metal gas container, stones that were quite warm and dry though it was raining outside. Soon after this, a friend from Sao Paulo came down to visit, and on his return home he described what he had been told to one of the city's Japanese language newspapers, which decided to send a reporter down to investigate. Brazilian journalists are noted for their wild irresponsibility when covering stories with a paranormal aspect, with the exception of such distinguished veterans as Wallace Leal V. Rodrigues, Jorge Rini and Moshe Jorge. But on this occasion the writer turned out to be as conscientious and competent as he was skeptical of anything paranormal. Skeptical to begin with, that is. 34-year-old Kazunari Akaki went down to the Okamoto farm on July 1 and spent 5 days there. As soon as he arrived after the long journey, over 600 miles, he was shown into the upper room over the storeroom, connected by a narrow stairway that could only be used by one person at a time. The room contained a bicycle, two gas containers, a hand cart and a number of smaller objects that, according to Okamoto, had been transported from down below. Akaki helped carry them down again, and then went off to town to see to his tourist visa. When he came back, everything he had moved was back in the upstairs room again. Clearly, he decided, Okamoto must be playing tricks. Stones began to fall during dinner, but Akaki was still unimpressed. As he was getting ready to go to bed, some wrapped chocolates fell onto the floor of his bedroom. They could, he decided, have been thrown over the partition. The following day, as Mrs. Okamoto was making up his bed, he heard a loud crash coming from the bedroom, and found a large truck wrench under the bed. Akaki, the most resolute of skeptics, was still unconvinced that anything paranormal was happening. There had to be a simple explanation. Somebody had to be playing tricks. The following afternoon he was forced, at last, to think otherwise. Returning from a drive in Okamoto's 2.5-ton Toyota Jeep, he left it parked outside the front door and went into the house. Immediately he got indoors, he heard a loud thud, and hurrying outside again he saw the Jeep some 40 yards away, with its front end resting against a wooden fence. He noted that there were no tire marks in the soft mud in between where he had left it and where it now most undoubtedly was. Moreover, the Jeep was in a position slightly uphill from where it had been parked. Akaki had left it in gear, and if it had somehow worked itself loose it would have rolled in the opposite direction. Akaki, now beginning to suspect that something genuinely unusual might indeed be going on, decided to make a test. Okamoto had told him that when the engine of the Jeep was running, objects seemed more prone to being thrown about, so he asked the farmer to bring the Jeep, undamaged except for a bent front mudguard, back to the front door and leave the engine running. He also noted that in the past, twilight had been a time for peak poltergeist activity. Sure enough, as soon as Akaki went back into the house, some torch batteries were flung against a wall, while upstairs in his bedroom where he had been only a few minutes previously, there was a large piece of iron rail lying on the bed. "I began to believe in the phenomena," he noted tersely. The piece of rail weighed 25 kilos and was nearly a meter long. Nobody could have carried it upstairs in the short time since he had been in the room before. The Paraguayan poltergeist was real. Even by Japanese standards, Kazunari Akaki showed a high degree of imperturbability, and before he returned to Sao Paulo he witnessed a number of other phenomena without showing the slightest sign of alarm. A pair of tires that had been tied to a post by a thick piece of steel cable were found in the upstairs room over the store. The cable snapped in two. Shoes appeared that had been lost days before. Clothing from a closed drawer was found hanging high in a tree as if left to dry in the sun. A bottle and a can of hairspray appeared on one of the crossbeams in the house, so high up that they could not be recovered without the use of a long ladder. Akaki duly noted all this, photographing what he could, and on his return to Sao Paulo he published a series of 18 articles in the bilingual journal Paulista, starting on July 11 and ending on September 18, 1972. Never had a Brazilian newspaper given such detailed coverage to a case of this kind. And was more there to come. In September, word reached Sao Paulo, accompanied by photographs and detailed descriptions, that the poltergeist had gone a stage further. It was now setting things on fire. The first object to combust, apparently spontaneously, at the Okamoto home was a damp shirt that was hanging on the back of a chair. A large circular hole was burned in the lower part of its back by a fireball, that appeared from nowhere and vanished at once, after also making a mark over an inch in diameter on the family dog. The dog was asleep at the time and did not even wake up. Dogs, as I was to see for myself on another case to be described here, tend to be absolutely useless on poltergeist cases. Next. Part of the wooden partition in the bathroom was struck by what seemed to have been a ray of lightning, to judge from the burn mark 9 feet long and about half an inch wide that was found there. Finally, a burn appeared on the thatched roof of a small hut near the main house, and why the whole hut did not burn down altogether remains a mystery, for no material is more inflammable than thatch. There was even more to come from Paraguay. In May 1973 the poltergeist began to play games with the Okamoto's 10-month-old baby. On one occasion, the baby, which had been sleeping in its pram, simply vanished altogether, pram and all. After a frantic search, it was found outside the house under a tree, dry and unlimbed although it was raining at the time. Eventually things quietened down and the Okamoto family learned to live with their unseen prankster. This case was unusual in that there was no obvious choice for an agent or epicenter. The only young girl involved was frequently away from the area when phenomena took place. These covered an unusually wide area, and no reason was ever found why anybody living or dead should want to bother the Okamoto family. In December 1972, an exhibition of the work of the Paraguay poltergeist was held at the Brazil-Japan Cultural Alliance in Sao Paulo. Many of the objects dislocated were shown, along with detailed drawings, plans of the house and numerous photographs. Although the Ruagasis, Sorocaba and Paraguay poltergeist cases each revealed points of interest, The classic Brazilian case remains the one that took place in the town of Suzano in 1970. This one is notable for its repeated manifestations of spontaneous combustion, and also for the quality of its evidence, for witnesses included no less a person than the local chief of police. IBPP researchers had their share of good luck.